realized he had not said goodbye to his father. He felt an odd tearing at his heart. He paused at the corner of Broadway and 74th, and half turned to catch his dad before he left for the office, then shook his head to clear it, and bought a bagel from a street vendor.
"Beowulf really spoke to you, Mitty," cried Mrs. Abrams joyfully. "As a topic for your paper for me, I suggest monsters in literature to capitalize on that brilliant thinking."
Mitty debated, saying, "Huh? What?" Or, "I'm not sufficiently acquainted with literature to find the requisite number of monsters for a fair analysis." He went with, "Huh?
Mr. Lynch tells me you're off and running on an outstanding report on smallpox," said Mrs. Abrams. "Supposing you were to compare Grendel and the other monsters in Beowulf to the monsters of infectious disease."
Mrs. Abrams clapped her hands with excitement.
"Smallpox," she clarified. "Typhoid. Plague."
Mitty was horrified. He couldn't imagine the work such a paper would take. He wanted a topic that required no work. Most of all, he wanted a topic with no fatal diseases.
"Good," said Mrs. Abrams. "That's settled."
Olivia IM'd. She was going to the girls' basketball game after school. Juliana was point guard. Zora might be a starter. Did Mitty want to go? Mitty was not a big fan of girls' high school basketball. He wasn't a big fan of Juliana and Zora, either. He would have to think about this. "Tell you at lunch," he wrote back. He didn't actually want to have lunch with anybody. He felt as if he had a new companion now, a very thoroughly lodged companion that would be with him until death, Variola Major. At lunch, he was cornered by Derek, who would not shut up. Derek had decided it was not a crazy individual who had murdered poor old Ottilie Lundgren before she could finish reading her mystery novel, but a crazy country.
"There's North Korea," Derek began. "Talk about insanity."
There were whole continents that didn't interest Mitty, and North Korea was in one of them. Derek moved on to the Middle East, where the list of potential anthrax lovers was long. Iraq, Iran, Syria, Lebanon, Egypt. He named groups and causes, leaders and fanatics. Then he forged into Africa, where Sudan and Ethiopia were filled with crazed persons with appalling histories, where funding might come from diamonds in Sierra Leone, and where mercenaries were available from any place where there'd been a recent civil war, which was every place. Olivia began discussing how AIDS had invaded many African countries. Derek was annoyed.
"I'm into terrorism, not sexually transmitted disease. My theory is that a rogue country is endlessly surfing the net, looking for opportunities, like investors endlessly researching profitable companies. The terrorists wouldn't specifically care what they found, any more than you care whether your stock is in farm tractors or casinos. You just want to earn money. The terrorists don't care if they find anthrax or smallpox. They just want to kill people. So they get their anthrax or whatever, pick a place like Grand Central Station, send a million commuters into such a panic they never take a train into New York again, and that destroys the economy and brings down a mayor and a governor and a president. And of course you'd have plenty of Americans who'll be glad to see that mayor, governor, and president brought down, so even though you're a terrorist and you're killing people, you'll have people on your side."
"No, you won't," said Olivia sharply. "No matter how much people don't like the party in office,
your outfit will have operational security," said Derek, raising his voice to drown Olivia out. "The guy in charge isn't going to scatter the anthrax. He's going to be a million miles away in the mountains of Pakistan or Afghanistan or Uzbekistan."
"The mountains of Afghanistan," said Olivia predictably, "are not a million miles away."
Derek was now speaking exclusively to Mitty.
"The mastermind sends his instructions online. He's supervising his minions electronically. And if the minions die of anthrax, who cares? They're always expendable. Anyway, if you're terrorizing people, the more victims, the better."
Mitty tried to swallow. Nothing happened. His throat refused to obey him. Mr. Lynch took them to the library again. Derek muttered that it was sure easy to be a teacher if all you did was escort people into the library. Everybody explained to Derek that it was sure easy to be a student if your teachers just escorted you into the library, so shut up. Olivia sat down next to Mitty.
Game or no game?
She was just about the most attractive person on earth, Mitty decided. She had her flaws, but who was Mitty to talk about flaws?
Game, he agreed.
She nodded and bounded off to continue her research. Setting such a fine academic example that Mitty decided he would wrap up this stupid biology report right now, during the 48 minutes of this period. Subtract 5 for settling in. If he wrote 1 sentence per minute, he'd never have to think about smallpox again. Bioterrorism. First consideration. Would it work? Since people weren't immunized anymore, the whole population of the world was at risk. Several sources agreed that 1 case of smallpox would multiply by a factor of 10, so an initial exposure of 50 people meant 500 exposed secondarily. But this is New York in 2004, thought Mitty. It wouldn't be 50 people. That was the olden days, when nobody went anywhere or did anything. Subway, store, school, gym, trains. I bet 1 victim could expose 500 people all by himself. And terrorists wouldn't choose Grand Central. They'd go for Penn Station. More trains, more traffic. Darker, sleazier, and more confusing, plus Madison Square Garden and all those tourists on top. Penn, not Grand Central, was the connecting station for Washington, D.C. and Florida. Mitty knew because every New Yorker knew that 500,000 people passed through Penn Station every weekday. All of them had to breathe. Perfect for that aerosol delivery. Penn Station was packed with National Guard and the NYPD and the transit police. It was safe. Mitty was comfortable there. His grandmother was comfortable there. But the best armed guards could not see a virus. And even if they could, they couldn't shoot it or stomp on it or lock it away. And since smallpox took 12 to 14 days to become visible, before the authorities knew a disease was out there, never mind which disease it was, thousands of people would be infected and couldn't be tracked down and couldn't be isolated and couldn't be treated and couldn't be ringed. It had taken the world only 20 years to reach 40 million cases of HIV. Smallpox, said one of Mitty's sources, might reach that number in 10 or 20 weeks. Olivia handed Mitty an old leather book. It was small and dainty, like a prayer book. He managed not to glare at her, but he definitely glared at the book. Don't get mad, said Olivia quickly. I'm not mad, he said, thinking that this was like dealing with his mother. Derek was on to something here. Was Olivia trying to rebuild him into a finer, more intellectual Mitty? Maybe he wouldn't go to the basketball game after all. Maybe it was time to pull out. Olivia's book was entitled The Travel Letters of Lady Mary Wortley Montagu. It had been written in the 1700s. Mitty was mental. It was bad enough going back 102 years. He wasn't going back 300. Olivia held up both palms, exactly like Mitty's mother, to ward off his tantrum. Lady Mary's husband was the British ambassador to Turkey, she said quickly. Back in England, Lady Mary had had smallpox so bad her face was ruined. She was terrified her son would get smallpox too and die or be disfigured. But in Turkey, smallpox didn't create as much trouble. What Turkish mothers would do is they would have a slumber party for all the neighborhood children. They'd scrape up the kids' arms and rub in pus from smallpox victims. Smallpox had to be the most disgusting thing on earth. And here was Olivia, an otherwise sane and pleasant person, forcing Mitty to consider even more gory details. The result was, Olivia said, Turkish kids would get mild cases of smallpox, but have no scars and be immune for good. Mitty tried not to scream. I'm not interested in kids in Turkey in 1700 or whatever, Olivia. There's another kind of old-fashioned immunity, she confided, but I haven't found out yet if Lady Mary knew about it. In China, people protected themselves from smallpox by a method called insufflation. What they would do is, they would grind dried smallpox scabs into a powder and breathe it up into their noses through a straw. And insufflation also conferred immunity. I haven't infected myself, thought Mitty. I've practiced insufflation. I'm immune. He tossed Lady Mary's letters into the air, caught the book juggler style, leaped up and flung his arms around Olivia, singing at the top of his lungs, "Celebrate good times, come on!" The librarian said, "Mitty Blake!" Mitty swung Olivia under one arm, ballroom style, seized the librarian's hand and yanked her forward, dance partner number 2. "Celebrate good times, come on!" he sang, whirling them in circles. "What happened?" Zora asked Emma. Did Mitty just propose or something? Stop it, hissed Olivia, who was not usually embarrassed by Mitty, but had to draw the line somewhere. Mitty! yelled Mr. Lynch, racing around the stacks. Celebrate good times, come on, Mitty sang one more time. Then he said to the assorted adults, sorry about that. He let go of his unwilling dance partners and lowered himself into his chair. Olivia vanished into the safety of her girlfriends. Derek sat down next to Mitty. What was all that about? Mitty was still laughing to himself. Stop it, said Derek. You sound like a lunatic. But I'm a happy lunatic. Naturally, Mitty went to the ball game. After all, there might be an appropriate moment to bellow, celebrate good times, come on. It was going to be his theme song now. Thank you, Cool and the Gang. Talk about classic rock. The girls didn't play well, no surprise to Mitty, and he drifted into consideration of other, better ball games. For days, he had not even thought of turning on the television, although normally college basketball consumed him from December through March. He was, of course, a UConn fan, because of the Blake's house in Connecticut. And it looked like a good year for UConn, what with Emeka Okafor and Ben Gordon on the men's team, and Diana Taurasi on the women's. Mitty didn't actually care about the women's team, but his mother never missed a game, and served dinner in front of the TV when her beloved Huskies were playing. She even had a crush on Gino Auriemma, their coach. What a crazy world it was. Imagine being consumed by smallpox instead of basketball. Mitty considered the weekend to come. He had planned to coax his parents to stay in the city because when they bailed every Friday afternoon, Mitty got left out of all the good stuff. He had planned to stay in New York, where he would finish, print out, and maybe even proofread his report. Forget that. He wanted to run around and cross-country ski, have another driving lesson with his father, and watch lots of television. And even if his mom won the to-do list, and this became the weekend when Mitty and his dad finally painted the front hall, whose walls were black with fingerprints, or so his mom claimed, although the wall looked pretty clean to Mitty, that would still be 100 times better a weekend than he had anticipated. Emma and Constance and a bunch of other girls wanted to know more about Mitty's sudden burst of ballroom dancing. If Mr. Lynch hadn't cut me off, Mitty told them, I would have serenaded Olivia for the rest of class. This guy's a keeper, Emma told Olivia. I was just thinking the opposite, said Olivia. Do not serenade me in public again, Mitchell Blake. It's probably the kind of thing a guy only needs to do once anyway, said Mitty. He kissed her on the lips, and the small crowd at the girls' game cheered. It had now been 5 days since Mitty Blake had opened the envelope. Chapter 8. The drive to the country was brutal, alternating snow and rain. The farther north they went, the worse the roads were. Mitty was fine with the weather forecast, which was for more of the same. Rotten weather was a perfect excuse to watch TV all night and all day. He deserved it. But Friday night and Saturday morning, Mitty caught up on his sleep instead of sitting in front of the tube. He had barely finished waking up when his mom and dad put on the television to watch UConn play an afternoon game. The Blakes had high snack standards for TV sports, so the long, low coffee table was covered with food options. Mitty, having missed breakfast and lunch, examined his choices carefully. He skipped anything vegetable, just as he skipped girls who were vegetarians. People who didn't want to go get a hamburger were tiring. Mitty was mainly a chipster. First choice was cheese doodles, because they turned his fingers yellow, and then he could lick them clean for a second helping. Next choice, spicy hot potato chips with plain sour cream dip. Nothing vegetable ruining the dip like chives or anything. Third choice, long thin pretzels, which he never ate but used to occupy himself during timeouts building little log cabins all over the table. His favorite non-chip option was baby hot dogs and their own fat little wads of dough, piping hot from the oven. His mom had everything, which was always the case, he thought contentedly, still warm in the glow of being healthy as opposed to being a global scourge victim. Naturally, in such an atmosphere, UConn won. After the game, Mitty and his dad discussed the possibility of a driving lesson. New York City restricted teenage driving, and basically, if you were 16, give it up. It was not a city for beginners, but Mitty's classmates were indifferent to driving anyway, because they already had their freedom. With a Metro card, they could take a bus or subway anywhere, and they did. A car, which eventually had to be parked, was not a plus in Manhattan. But in Connecticut, having a license mattered. His mother opposed the driving lesson. The roads are slick, she said firmly.
When Mitty and his dad went outside to assess the weather, they were forced to agree. But by the time they got back to the television, Mitty's mom had figure skating on. Neither Mitty nor his father considered figure skating a sport.
How come we only have one television here? Mitty asked.
Because in the country we want to be a family, whispered his dad, so he would not drown out the TV commentary, and do everything together.
Then together you and I should seize the remote, Dad, Mitty whispered back, and hold it hostage. Mitty's mom was giggling, but not meeting their eyes, because she might give in, and end up looking at a car race or even wrestling. She wrapped herself around the remote. Watching his mother, Mitty was seized by affection so intense that he had to look away. Mitty loved his family, but he didn't usually notice loving them. This kind of thing had been happening to him all week. Sunday morning, Mitty briefly considered doing homework. Luckily, he hadn't remembered to bring it along, so instead he drowsed happily, moving seamlessly from breakfast to brunch. He had barely put his dishes in the dishwasher when it was time to head back to the city. After having slept most of the weekend, Mitty also slept in the car. But once they were inside the apartment, Mitty came face to face with the fact that Sunday was followed by Monday. Mitty hated how this happened every week. How Sunday accelerated, leaping feet first into Monday, depriving a person of weekend joy. School really ought to start on Tuesday. He recalled now that he had meant to accomplish tons of things, freeing himself from his biology report and thinking up a no-effort topic for that English paper. Mitty summoned up some energy. He was down to the last two smallpox topics, ancient preventive techniques and vaccination supply. Olivia was never wrong, and he could probably put her in his bibliography for ancient preventive techniques. But Mr. Lynch wouldn't be amused, so Mitty went to work with his books and online to grab a few facts. He learned two. First, the arm-scraping technique of old Turkish slumber parties wasn't what Mitty had pictured. You didn't get a shot and go on with your life. The Turkish technique actually gave you smallpox, except it was very mild. And the slumber party had to last for weeks because the kids had to be quarantined. They weren't very sick, but they were just as infectious as if they'd gotten the real thing. And anybody who caught smallpox from these kids did get the real thing. That, of course, was if it worked. It didn't always work. Second, insufflation, which the Chinese had practiced, usually did not work. If it had worked, smallpox would have disappeared. Mitty's mouth got dry again. Then he read up on vaccine supply. The puzzle of why the government wanted vaccines when they weren't going to vaccinate anybody was solved. Mitty should have read this stuff earlier. In fact, he should have read everything earlier, and in order, and paying attention. His typing was worse than usual. Practically every word on his screen was highlighted because of spelling errors. Mitty didn't correct them. He just typed on. Nobody gets vaccinated for smallpox anymore, but we have a big supply of vaccine. If smallpox managed to reappear, probably due to terrorists getting hold of the virus, doctors think that if they vaccinate an exposed person before the fourth day, maybe they can't stop the guy from getting smallpox, but he might have a less terrible case. But by the fourth day, the virus has taken over too many cells. It's too powerful. No vaccine would have an effect. There is no hope. Mitty hit print. He checked the date and time. Sunday, February 8, 11:45 p.m. Subtract Sunday, February 1, 4 o'clock p.m. A week had passed since Mitty Blake had handled and inhaled smallpox remains. No vaccine would have an effect. There was no such thing as insufflation. At some point during his sleepless night, Mitty turned on the light. He felt an uncontrollable desire to wash his hands. This was pathetic. He had handled those scabs days ago. His bedroom was too quiet. He opened his window a few inches. Cold air leaped in and he froze, but it was worth it. Garbage trucks lifting and grinding all over the west side made a welcome racket. Then he went online, casually, as if just planning to check his mail. In fact, Mitty and his friends did not email all that much. They didn't phone either. They did a lot of text messaging. In middle school, Mitty had had 54 best friends with whom he had routinely communicated. Back then, he knew everybody's screen name,
even the people who had two or three of them, and if he didn't hear from somebody once a week, he was angry. In ninth grade, his list had diminished, and by 10th, it had narrowed to a handful. But this year, along with everything else he was not doing, he was not keeping in touch. Derek and Olivia were pretty much the extent of his buddy list. Even when he'd been a pretty decent student, Mitty had never been an Olivia, bursting with questions and answers. It seemed unlikely that he would ever fight for a first-row chair, wave his hand madly, and shout out opinions on British literature. But now, a 3:15 on a Monday morning, he was online, and he was a person madly shouting out. He had already been to the sites of NIH, Homeland Security, and FEMA, Federal Emergency Management, in charge of the vaccine stockpile. Now he went to his favorite search engine to look for experts. ImmunoQuest turned out to be somebody's personal wellness site. ViroQuest was software. Jimunol.org was the journal of immunology, where you could read anything for free, and Mitty was excited until he pulled up a title about smallpox. Targeting antigen in mature dendritic cells for simultaneous stimulation of CD4+ and CD8+ T cells. Right. The American Association of Immunologists wanted him to be a member before they would tell him anything, and immuno.org was for sale. But the Clinical Immunology Society had a forum on infectious disease. Mitty wrote in the hope that they would post his question. Last week, researching a term paper on smallpox, I came upon actual smallpox scabs. Am I the only person except the CDC with smallpox remains? At ImmunoQuery, he typed in smallpox and was taken to a response page where he found a request submitted by a doctor. I wish to contact survivors of smallpox. I recognize there will be very few still alive in America, so hope to hear from survivors perhaps in Bangladesh or India. If you are a survivor or know of survivors, please email. Mitty wrote to her. I am not a survivor, but I just found scabs from the 1902 Boston epidemic, which might interest you. Mitty had a number of email addresses. Sometimes he used whatabummer@aol.com or mittb@hotmail.com. His school address was mblack@straff.edu. He rarely used that one because the only communications were from disappointed teachers. Even more disappointed now, probably, because he had never read their emails, never mind their assignments. To the International Infectious Disease Research Council, he submitted this. I just found smallpox scabs from a 1902 epidemic. Is it possible to extract variola virus from these scabs, and if so, how? To the science editors of the Boston Globe, I just found smallpox scabs from Boston's 1902 epidemic. Would anybody in a Boston medical school like to examine these and also help with my term paper? To the American Society of Infectious Disease Specialists, he wrote a different message. If a person stumbled on intact smallpox scabs and breathed in the dust of them and rubbed them against his nose and mouth, would that person be at risk? This was the question that mattered. But maybe he wouldn't send it. Mitty had come to a conclusion. When Donald Henderson's team, if you could call 10,000 health workers by the plain old word team, had ringed sick guys, they just waited out the illness. Those sick guys must have shed smallpox scabs all over their beds and blankets and houses. There would have been a zillion. But the World Health Organization guys just headed home. If scabs could actually pass on the disease, wouldn't they have had to sweep up the scabs each time? So it was stupid to worry. And that was why he wasn't writing to the CDC, who were way too official for stupid questions and had better things to do than worry about some kid's high school paper. Because that was all this was. A high school paper. Nothing more, nothing less. He was such a loser, he'd been scared of light and dark on Roosevelt Island. He was really a loser to be having smallpox nightmares. He'd better not become a doctor. He'd get every symptom of every illness in every textbook. Of course, with his grades, he wasn't getting into bartender school, never mind medical school. The best thing, Mitty decided, was to toss both the scabs and the book. This would end their crazy grip on him. He would flush the scab dust down the toilet, throw the book down the garbage shaft, and put this behind him. He picked up Principles of Contagious Disease to retrieve the envelope. As they had been doing all week, facts leaped up off the pages and attacked. Prior to vaccination, 400,000 smallpox deaths occurred in a routine year in Europe, but only one-third of smallpox patients died, so the actual number getting smallpox was 1.2 million. And those guys were spread out, thought Mitty, with rivers and mountain ranges in between. They just sat there in their little feudal huts. They weren't catching the subway, 30,000 here and 20,000 there. Nothing separates New Yorkers from each other. Most epidemics, the book informed him next, were in winter. Smallpox spread better in cold weather. From the window, Mitty felt cold weather. And then he found the page where the envelope had been resting all those 102 years. It had discolored the page, leaving a rusty 2-inch by 6-inch patch. In this book, written by doctors who knew their smallpox, who had buried its victims, autopsied them, and slid their scabs into envelopes, it said, "After a patient got well, not only should every surface in his room be disinfected, not only should his clothing and bedding be burned, not only should his furniture be destroyed, the wallpaper in that patient's room should be scraped off and burned." Mitty was strung out like a guy on his 10th cup of coffee. He put the book down. He forgot about getting rid of the envelope. In the silent dark, he padded to the kitchen and ate ice cream out of the carton. The chocolate felt good going down his sore throat. 12 to 14 days before a person is infectious, thought Mitty. Today is February 9. Only a few safe days left. Unless this is some other strain of variola major, a quick strain, an infect-you-in-10-days strain. Mitty took the carton of ice cream into the living room with a fabulous skyline view. They never pulled a shade or a curtain in this room. Night and day, summer and winter, they had Manhattan for their neighbor. He finished the whole carton. At last, he slumped down on the pillows and dozed fitfully. In his bedroom, on the computer screen, the little flag of incoming mail began blinking. Chapter 9. Mitty never knew why he was in school on Mondays, but he really didn't know why he was in school this Monday. Classes felt like strange rituals devised by some unknown tribe. Desks and pencils, computers and hallways were alien objects. Friends were difficult to recognize, and conversation was impossible. Nobody noticed. Derek talked about his favorite subjects. Teachers rattled on about their favorite subjects. Olivia chattered about her favorite subject. Mitty was silent, thinking about his emails. Would anybody answer? If they did, could he trust their answers? What would he do if the answers seemed to indicate that he, Mitty Blake, might actually be getting smallpox? He didn't feel as if he occupied his flesh in the usual way. His body was a container. He was standing inside it, like a person badly dressed. At lunch, Derek expounded on anthrax. Olivia offered to share her Rice Krispie marshmallow bar, but Mitty didn't want to touch it. He didn't want to touch anything. "Are you all right?" Olivia asked. "He's fine," said Derek, irritably. Olivia flushed. "I am fine, thanks, Olivia," Mitty said. How sober his voice was. He could not inject it with his usual. "What is my usual?" he thought. When school ended, Mitty stood in the foyer. He let his backpack slide to the floor. He examined his palms. Lesions started at the extremities. Hands, head, and feet were first and worst. "Mitty, what's wrong?" said Olivia with her little frown of concern. He shoved his hands into his pockets. "Don't you have to hurry to your ballet class?"
"Yes, but what's the matter?"
He changed the subject. "I wouldn't mind seeing you in tights." She beamed at him.
"I have a solo in the recital the first Saturday in March."
He started to say, "I wouldn't miss that for anything." But this was not true. At home, in the safety of his bedroom, Mitty turned on his laptop and went online. He opened mblack@straff.edu. 27 messages were waiting. He couldn't bring himself to open them. He got up and opened a real window instead, studied traffic for a while, put on the radio, chose a soda. Then he double-clicked. "Re-scabs. I am a science reporter for the Boston Globe. Where did you get these scabs? When can we do an interview? phone, email, or if you're near Boston, let's meet. The science reporter just wanted an article. He wasn't nervous, wasn't afraid. Ree Scabs, your email was forwarded to me. I am a virologist at Harvard Medical School. When did you find this scab, and how did you identify it? Email or call promptly. So somebody with great credentials was interested, and he didn't sound nervous either. Ree Scabs, I am with USAMRID, the U.S. Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases. We need to examine the scab you have. Answer ASAP. Ree Scabs, thank you for contacting the International Association for Infectious Disease Research. IAIDR would like to obtain the scabs. Infectivity may have survived. Please call the phone number below or email immediately. Infectivity was the ability to infect. Infectivity may have survived? Mitty thought. Well, it didn't. If infectivity had survived, the Harvard guy would have said so. And then he thought, wait, I didn't write to you, USAMRID. I didn't write to any government agency. I'm not into authority right now. So somebody had forwarded Mitty's message. He had known for several days now that he was not in control of his body or his health, but somehow he had expected to be in control of his own questions. Ree Scabs, your email was forwarded to me. Where on earth did you find scabs of smallpox? How do you know that's what they are? Did you touch them? Call the hotline of your CDC. This was from a doctor in Germany. Mitty had written to sites with the word international in their title, but he figured international was just a word like association or fellowship, but of course it wasn't, especially not on the web. Ree Scabs, I am an infectious disease researcher with a collection of material related to epidemics. I would very much like to examine these scabs and possibly purchase them. When and where did you locate them? That was the sickest hobby Mitty had ever heard of. A guy who bought disease leftovers? But Mitty was drawn to sick people. Besides, this message was kind of fun, and Mitty felt in need of a little fun, so he wrote back. I'm the one with the smallpox scabs. The collector was online and answered in real time, which was a nice coincidence. I would do anything to get those. Mitty responded. I know some sick people, but you're out there, man. I'm a collector. Collectors are nuts. I own the lancet Edward Jennings used when he cut James Phipps' arm open for the very first vaccination. It looks like a switchblade made of tortoiseshell. Want to see it? Wouldn't a thing like that be in some important British museum, thought Mitty? Or a medical school exhibit? When did you find the scabs? Wrote the collector. Last Sunday, in an envelope inside an old medical text. You've been handling them for 7 days? You near a major medical center? I'm in New York. I'm near 50 major medical centers. I'm in New York, too. Let's meet so I can get the scabs and you can see my other stuff. Mitty had a moment of caution. Kids in New York City had more independence by far than kids in suburbs. In suburbs, their moms had to drive them. In the city, kids learned to navigate on their own. They spent their childhoods getting safety lectures and holding hands and pairing up during school excursions, and then they walked out the door into a vast city. Almost always, they were just fine. Almost. This guy, or woman, was maybe too weird to meet. Mitty abandoned him and opened the next message. Ree Scabs, I am an infectious disease researcher with a pharmaceutical firm and would be very excited to examine those scabs. If you live near me, I'll take you to our research facilities. We could use my scanning electron microscope so you can photograph virions of your very own scab. If you don't live near me, I'll find a colleague in your area, Dr. J.H.D. Redder. Mitty loved those three initials. Maybe instead of changing from Mitty Blake to Mitchell Blake, he'd become M.J. Blake. He found a paper and pencil and wrote M.J. Blake. Boring. It needed that third initial. Mitty entertained himself with selections of initials. He'd always been fond of the letter X. M.X.J. Blake? No. He doubled one of his initials. M.M.J. Blake. He liked it. Then he answered Dr. Redder's email, because although he had no idea what a scanning electron microscope was, it had to be better than the junk in the school science lab, And he didn't know what a Virion was either, but photographs of his own Virions would definitely one-up Nate. Dr. Redder, too, was online at that moment and cruised right up with a response. Late afternoon was a pretty common time to be online because people were checking their end-of-the-day mail, but Mitty was a little surprised to have been reached by two in a row. It was like middle school when nobody had anything to do except communicate. When did you locate the smallpox scabs? Mitty and Dr. Redder went through the same exchange of information he had gone through with the collector. Where are you? I'll find a lab with an SEM. New York, answered Mitty, which wasn't giving much away. 8 million other people were in New York, too. Terrific. I'm at New York Presbyterian. I was just up there at the medical library, typed Mitty, and immediately regretted it. Dr. Redder would expect a brilliant student to show up. Mitty wasn't one. He decided to bring Olivia along. I'll make you a 3D image of your specific virus on the SEM. Mitty thought, wait. You can't be with a pharmaceutical firm and also be with New York Presbyterian, can you? I'll get back to you, he wrote. Mitty had a bad history of getting back to people at the best of times, but this guy was too eager. Mitty moved on. He was sorry he had emailed anybody. He couldn't be going around displaying his scabs like a sideshow and making appointments with people to schedule envelope openings. M. Black. Thank you for contacting our site. We have a policy of not responding to questions from students doing papers. We suggest sites linked to this one. Same to you, thought Mitty. He was feeling pretty normal again. Sure, one outfit thought infectivity might have survived, and the doctor in Germany wanted him to call a hotline, but everybody else seemed pretty low-key. The next message was from the woman who had been looking for survivors. Re-scabs. I don't think the scab could be contagious after all this time. Viruses tend toward a shelf life measured in hours or days, but I don't know. I don't suppose anyone knows. I forwarded your email to the CDC. Meanwhile, please telephone me promptly to discuss this. If there is infectivity, it must be controlled. I need to examine the scabs in my laboratory. This was the only person whose responses he knew were real, because he had answered her. Everybody else could be insane guys with political problems staying up all night and telling lies. If there is infectivity. Re-scabs. Your email was forwarded to me. How long have you had these scabs? Are they infectious? I guess not, or you'd be dead by now, and so would your country. How do you know they're smallpox? Re-scabs. Your email was forwarded to me. I'm a public health physician in Louisiana. A case of smallpox would take precedence over any health problem on Earth. Go to the CDC homepage and notify them that you have been exposed to dangerous material. Re-scabs. It's barely 3 years since we had an anthrax scare, and you're trying to start a smallpox scare? I forwarded your threatening email to the FBI. An email from Mitty Blake, bottom of the junior class at St. Raphael's, had been forwarded to the FBI? If the FBI and the CDC didn't have people reading stuff on Sunday night, and Mondays were too busy, they'd read it Tuesday. First, they'd figure out who mblack@straph.edu was. Government agencies could order a provider to hand over information, so the FBI would know in a heartbeat what straph.edu was. One call to St. Raphael's, and they'd be told M. Black's full name, address, phone number, and probably his grade point average and where his mother was born. Of course, now that he thought about it, pretty much anybody with half a brain would know that EDU meant a school. They would separate Straff into St. Raph and come up with St. Raphael's. Probably several schools in America were named St. Raphael's, and he knew of at least one hospital. But it wouldn't take long to narrow down. Even the guy in Germany must have guessed Mitty was American, because Mitty wrote in English and referred to a term paper. The FBI? Come on. They had better things to do. A case of smallpox would take precedence over any health problem on Earth. In which case, no. The FBI would not have better things to do. Hey, Mitt! Yelled his father. The front door slammed. Mitty shut down his email. Mitty! Caroled his mother. We're home! Do you want to order pizza? There's a UConn game tonight! Notre Dame! We're going to slaughter them! But Mitty Blake was playing a more serious game. Chapter 10. It was a close game. His parents were excited, and then desperate, cheering, and then moaning. It was all Mitty could do to mumble a syllable now and then. He wanted to tell his parents everything, but he wanted them away from him, miles away, oceans away. And here they were on the same sofa. He couldn't follow the game. He, Mitty, who loved college basketball the most of any sport. When the camera panned the crowd at Notre Dame, he saw only Variola Major working its way through 11,000 people. UConn lost. Mitty hardly noticed. Normally, Mitty yelled and stomped, threw things and high-fived, placed rational or insane bets, and groaned afterward about how UConn should have played better. Now he just waited quietly while his father wound down from the excitement and the frustration of a loss, until at last Mitty could retire to the safety and privacy of his room. He couldn't sit, couldn't lie down, couldn't do anything except listen to the echoes of electronic voices. Infectivity may have survived. Answer ASAP. A case of smallpox would take precedence over any health problem on Earth. I have forwarded your email to the FBI. He was aware of his parents in their room and the blockade of closets and bathrooms between them. He heard when they turned off their bedroom TV and closed their books. Except for sports, they never watched TV without also reading. It seemed to Mitty that they missed the entire point of television. At last, all was still, and they were asleep. And Mitty, too, was still. When he was little, Mitty had often been mesmerized by the round windows and the humming clothes dryers down in the building's laundry room. He would stand holding his nanny's hand, watching socks inside get thrown against the glass, then underwear, followed by pillowcases. And here would come those socks again. His thoughts had always been like that, like flailing sleeves of shirts revolving and tumbling. The cycle had ended. Mitty's mind lay as quiet as folded laundry. Call the CDC hotline. If he called the CDC and said, I opened this old book and handled old smallpox scabs and I might be infected, wouldn't they just laugh? But if they didn't laugh, if they came to his house, wanted to examine him, then what? He did not want to be a specimen. Demon in the Freezer described what happened to an English victim in the 1970s who'd gotten sick from a laboratory accident, and to a German victim in 1969 who'd been traveling through India in an area where smallpox still existed. These patients had become display items, public property. They had been stared at, studied, and examined. And furthermore, every person they had come near had been stared at, studied, and examined. Those two victims had had no meaning to anybody except that they could kill by breathing. Typhoid Mary. Nobody had cared what that poor woman thought or hoped for. Her life didn't matter. She was a threat. Lock her up. Mitty thought, as he often did, because it was every athlete's fear, about the most unfortunate ball player in history, Bill Buckner, who let a ground ball roll between his legs and lost Game 6 of the 1986 World Series for the Red Sox. Bill Buckner entered history because of one split second when he goofed. Mitty, too, would find a place in history, but his would be worse. He'd be the one who brought smallpox back. If he got smallpox, they would ring-vaccinate Manhattan. There would be immunization stations in Grand Central and at St. Raphael's. The city would go through hell, all because Mitty Blake had done his homework for a change. Mitty slept in shorts and an extra-large Old Navy t-shirt. Around 2 a.m., he went into his bathroom and peeled them off. In front of the mirrors, he examined himself. No lesions. But it was too early anyway. This was not yet dawn of day 10. He took out his old medical texts again. He didn't care what anybody modern said. He needed guys who knew what they were talking about, who'd been there, done that, buried the victims. Each old source said the same thing. No symptoms and no way to infect anybody else for 12 to 14 days after exposure. He felt like a person who knows perfectly well why he's coughing, bleeding, and exhausted. He's got cancer. But he still won't go to the doctor, because as long as the diagnosis isn't definite, it's possible to pretend. There was a difference here. If you didn't treat your cancer, it was your problem. But if you didn't treat smallpox, it was the world's problem. If Mitty pretended he was fine, and then he got smallpox and infected other people, Mitty Blake would be a murderer. Because he would have known. It would not be an accident. What were the chances that he would get sick?
A chance in a thousand? A chance in a million? Any chance was still a chance. That was why people bought lottery tickets. Somebody had to win. And somebody had to lose. Mitty considered the possibilities. A. He wouldn't get smallpox, and he'd still have to write that paper comparing monsters to diseases. That alone might kill him. B. He wouldn't get smallpox, but he'd be too lazy to write the paper, and he'd flunk English along with every other subject. C. He wouldn't get smallpox, he'd write brilliant papers, graduate a year early with high honors, and make everybody proud. D. He'd get smallpox. Mitty was suddenly gripped by a new fear, that he had lost the envelope. Guys in dark suits carrying hidden weapons would descend on him, and he'd have nothing. They'd yell, "What envelope, you liar? Wasting government time? Terrifying Manhattan? And you never had anything? You made it up so you could be the center of attention?" They'd toss the apartment, make his mother cry, probably fine Mitty, or even jail him for wasting their time. His father would regard him with that sad look, the one that said, "I want to be proud of you, son, but yet again." Mitty's fear was well placed. There was no envelope in the book. He held the book by its spine and shook it upside down, and carefully turned every page a second time. Mitty's pulse rate would have been just right if he was a hummingbird. He'd taken the book to school. Had the envelope fallen out in the library? Was it floating around? Did Olivia have it? His mom? The maid? Then Mitty swore, threw the stupid book down, and picked up the right one. The envelope was exactly where he'd left it. In a minute, he'd be scared of spiders. He checked the contents of the envelope. "I just proved why I'm at the bottom of the junior class," thought Mitty. "The only thing stupider than handling the virus once is to handle it a second time." He came to one decision anyway. He was getting rid of the scabs. If the FBI did show up, which they wouldn't, the whole idea was ridiculous. They had better things to do. But if they did... So, what if he didn't have scabs? He decided on the waterlogged route because he didn't want airborne dust floating around. He went into the kitchen, got a heavy-duty black plastic garbage bag, put the book into the bag, set it in his sink, and filled it from the tap. The book did not sop up water, so he riffled the pages to let the water in. Some scientist somewhere would grieve. This scab was never going to be tested by anybody for anything. When the book had turned to paste, he tied the bag shut, put it inside a second bag, and went to the front door of his apartment. Building rules required carpet so that people living beneath you didn't hear your footsteps. And the Blakes had very thick padding under very thick carpet. No need to tiptoe. He opened the deadbolt carefully, so no metallic snick would disturb his parents' sleep. Leaving the door ajar, he went down the hall to the trash room. He opened the waist-high slot in the wall and dropped his nightmare down the chute. It would hit bottom and join the garbage from all the other apartments, be collected in even larger plastic bags, and set out on the sidewalk for the garbage men. Get tossed into a truck, driven to the river, emptied onto a scow, and barged to a landfill. Back in his bedroom, he thought, I could go off to some remote place and tough it out alone. I wouldn't have to stick it out very long. If I bail tomorrow and hide somewhere by Sunday morning, which is day 15, I'll know the score. Where could he hide out? His Aunt Betty had a terrific little retreat in the woods in the Adirondacks, up near Lake Placid. But even if he could get there, which he couldn't, it wasn't heated. The water was turned off for the winter and there was no food. There would be snow, though, and the people looking after the cabin would see Mitty's tracks. And once he found wood and kindling and started a fire in the little stove, they'd see smoke rising and come over. What would Mitty do then? Call out, "Hi, don't come in, fatal disease here." But say he did come up with a hiding place. If he didn't get smallpox, Sunday afternoon he could phone his parents, who would be a little bent out of shape by then, but that happened when you had a son, and make up some story. It would have to be quite a story. If he did get sick, he was looking at 5 or 6 weeks of suffering and healing. Every description of smallpox was gruesome, but one really gruesome thing was that you were so sick you couldn't get out of bed. You not only couldn't nurse yourself, but you got stuck to your own mattress when your pustules oozed and dried up. So if he went to the cabin in the mountains, he'd be too sick to get up. Plus, he'd freeze to death when the wood stove went out. Or he could call the CDC.
Anybody else would summon experts, counselors, agencies, and advisors, but Mitty wanted to face it alone. He did not want his parents making this decision for him. He did not want doctors making the decision for him. And most certainly he did not want a government agency doing it. It was his life, his body. In some book or other, he remembered somebody saying about somebody else, better if he had never lived. Did he remember this from church, maybe? The only book in church was generally the Bible. Who had the Bible said that about? What if people said of Mitty, better if he had never lived? It was still dark out when Mitty headed to school. Streetlights illuminated Broadway. The occasional taxi cruised by. Manhattanites didn't have to get up early, since they were already there, but lots of people had stuff to do before work. They were already walking dogs, running a few pre-morning shower miles, going out to buy a paper or fresh bagels. Mitty was cut off by an actual club of young mothers, babies warm and barely visible behind the zipped-up plastic over their strollers, headed to Central Park for a dawn jog. He didn't see anybody who deserved to get smallpox. He went to a diner at the corner of 68th and Columbus and ordered scrambled eggs, bacon, fried potatoes, toast, fresh-squeezed orange juice, and coffee. Before it came, he was starving. When it was set in front of him, he had no appetite. Mitty's parents always woke up to 10-10 wins. All news, all the time. You give us 22 minutes, we'll give you the world. Mitty's mother was calm during traffic and weather, but she could get anxious about headline news. Would it be bad? Would it be worse? It would be worse if smallpox came back. His father found the color-coded Homeland Security terror warnings both exhausting and comic. Say it was yellow. Exactly what caution was he supposed to follow? Skip the gym? If it got raised, was he supposed to stay home from work? Smallpox would be a reason to stay home. Mitty studied his watch, calculating the deadline. He'd get through the day somehow without saying anything to anybody, unless, of course, the FBI showed up, although even in his action movie-trained mind, Mitty could not picture being called out of class to chat with FBI agents. Tonight, he'd tell his parents what was up, because the only thing worse than finding out would be finding out from strangers. Then, together, they'd call that CDC hotline. And he knew, he completely knew, he knew for a fact, the CDC would say, 100-year-old scabs? What a joke! Finish your little school paper, sonny, and don't bother us again. Unless they put him in isolation and hovered over him wearing 20 layers of protective material, while television news showed sobbing St. Ray students getting shots. At the diner, Mitty left a full plate and a large tip. He slung his backpack over one shoulder and headed toward school. He was still early. Nobody else would even be dressed yet. He found himself oddly uncomfortable with the press of pedestrians, and instead of walking up Columbus or Amsterdam or Broadway, he shifted over to West End Avenue. But even West End, practically vacant compared to the other streets, felt packed. Mitty shifted even farther west to Riverside Drive. He never walked here. It was boring. It was not Mitty's nature to seek solitude. Mitty loved a crowd. Strangers often commented on how New Yorkers did not make eye contact. Strangers figured that every New Yorker was afraid of every other New Yorker, but that wasn't the reason. If you looked into the eyes of the person coming in your direction, you were drawn toward him, and the two of you bumped into each other. But if your eyes didn't meet, you avoided each other perfectly, even on crowded platforms during rush hour. Only once, New Year's Eve in Times Square, had Mitty been in a crowd too tight for him to move, let alone avoid contact. He had made friends with everybody in the mob. He cut past the statue of Eleanor Roosevelt and hardly noticed the fenced-in dog exercise park, where usually he fell in love with at least one dog. He went through a windy pedestrian tunnel under the West Side Highway, already solid with commuter cars, and came out on the stretch of park that ran for miles along the Hudson River. He walked past the marina, empty ball fields, and the shut-down restaurants of summer. He could not walk fast enough to escape the thoughts crawling over him. I don't want to be near people, because the books could be wrong about the 12 days, he thought. What if it's only 9 days? What if it's now? His cell rang, but he didn't look at it. The desire to communicate had left Mitty. He felt curiously outside of his skin, or maybe inside it, waiting for his variola to detonate. Mitty Blake sat on a bench facing the Hudson and the low, dull buildings of New Jersey on the far side. A red tug pulled a long barge. A traffic helicopter surveyed the George Washington Bridge. He balanced his laptop on his knees and began to write. "So, Mom, Dad, this is a letter. I'm trying to be intelligent here, even though it goes against a lifetime of training. Nothing you trained me in, I promise. You always did the right thing. I trained myself to be stupid. First, read my science report. Then you'll know what smallpox is. What it is a real, true weapon of mass destruction. Now, you finished reading that. Here's what happened on Sunday, February 1. In one of the old medical texts you bought from that doctor, Mom, I found an envelope full of scabs from a smallpox epidemic in 1902. I handled them, breathed in their dust. So now what? Could I, Mitty Blake, get smallpox from those scabs? I can't tell. I've been doing research all week and I still can't tell. The odds are in my favor that the virus is dead, but print out my emails from where I asked around. You'll see what the majority opinion is. It might not be dead. I could have called the CDC in Atlanta. They handle AIDS and West Nile virus and SARS and stuff. And they could have given me a vaccine, which might or might not have had an effect. I think they're guessing about whether it could help, but it's too late. I wasn't paying attention. All I cared about was, do I need one more sentence for my stupid paper? It isn't the paper that's stupid. Because here's the thing. Suppose inside my body the first live smallpox in 2 generations is getting ready to burst. Whether I live or die, whether I'm scarred or not, that stuff doesn't matter. What matters is that the virus would exist. In only hours I might be infecting people. Me! It's impossible. Except it's possible. I'm afraid. I've got an idea now what this disease is, but I'm more afraid of giving it to other people. That would be the bad part. Not getting it, but giving it. You're saying to me, Mitty, just go to a hospital. That sounds easy, but I don't want to be an exhibit. This girl in biology class, Marcy, her disease is avian flu, which has been in the news all month. Chickens in Asia get the flu, which also sounds impossible. It's so human. Do the chickens get a fever and a cough? Anyway, the people handling these chickens also get the flu. Marcy is all proud of this photograph she cut from the Post of sisters in Thailand who died of avian flu. They're lying in their coffins. The pictures have been printed all over the world. You know what? Nobody's going to photograph me lying in my coffin or covered with smallpox. Plus, I don't want to be stupid. Say I rush to the authorities, whimpering and scaring the whole city, and people go berserk and seal their doors and 1 million plane flights get canceled, and nothing happens. I'm just this low IQ jerk. But if I do get smallpox, aside from the photographs of me in my coffin, they'll do that ring vaccination Dr. Henderson perfected. The problem is, Americans don't stay in their rings like some peasant in a Bangladesh rice field 50 years ago. They get on planes, trains, buses, and ferries. They drive SUVs, vans, cars, and motorcycles. They leave town. They leave the state. They leave the country. My virus would hit the world. Read that paragraph on how fast the entire population of the world would get smallpox. I know soldiers in Iraq are afraid. I know refugees in Sierra Leone or Rwanda or Afghanistan are afraid. But they can see the thing they're afraid of. I can't see what I'm afraid of.